Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Tricia Beattie. Today I'll be reading from the April 1st issue of the Christian Science Monitor. In the limited time we have, I'll read from their section called One Week, which is a series of brief articles and commentary on the top stories of the past few days. Millennials Tiptoe Toward Better Chance for Home Ownership by Lauren Belsey and Leonardo Bellavacqua, staff writers. Michael, alas, is thinking about buying his first home. It depends in part on whether he lands a job that he's interviewed for. It would mean more money and a move from rural Mississippi, where he works as a college recruiter, to the state capital, Jackson. "I never thought I'd even consider this," he says, "but I realize it is more of a possibility than it was last year and the year before and the year before that." Like a lot of millennials, the 30-something Mr. Alas is slower than people in prior generations to pursue this piece of the American dream. Nevertheless, hopes are on the rise that an extraordinarily tough housing market is finally about to ease. Mortgage rates are down a full point since peaking at a two-decade high last October, and are expected to fall further as the Federal Reserve begins cutting interest rates later this year. Falling rates should convince more homeowners to sell and more home buyers to buy. In February, more homes came on the market than in any four-week period in 3 years, according to real estate brokerage Redfin. Still, the adjustment is likely to be slow. Mortgage rates may not come down by much this year. Construction companies aren't building enough new homes to satisfy demand. And many young adults are still struggling to pay off student debt. The longer this adjustment takes, the greater the wealth gap between current homeowners and young adults who can't afford to buy a home. This gap yawns widest for low-income renters and people of color, whose parents typically can't help with down payments. These trends threaten to make America's existing wealth disparities even greater. A decline in mortgage rates will certainly improve affordability for some households, says Carolina Reed, professor of city and regional planning at the University of California, Berkeley. But the age and the wealth and the income disadvantages all intersect and are particularly pronounced for Black and Hispanic households. Coleman Hemsath, 31, is one of the fortunate ones. After paying some $3,000 a month for a small place in Manhattan, he and his partner moved recently into a two-bedroom house in Jersey City, New Jersey. "We were in a cramped apartment," he says. "We have a dog. It was time to get serious, and also a yard." In many ways, Mr. Hemsath is ahead of his generation. Younger than the average first-time homebuyer, who is 35, the National Association of Realtors reported last year, he has more time to take advantage of home price appreciation and tax deductions to grow his wealth. A 2018 Urban Institute study found that those who bought a home before age 35 amassed nearly twice the housing wealth of those who waited until later to purchase their first home. Kenji Jimenez, a renter in Pomona, California, falls into the latter category. It's not for lack of effort. In his early 40s, Mr. Jimenez has been looking for 2 years and has worked hard to improve his credit rating. Even though rent consumes nearly half of his $40,000 income, he has cobbled $30,000 to $35,000 together for a down payment. But given that he lacks a cosigner, his income is too low to qualify for a bank loan for the $450,000 to $500,000 homes he's looking at. And he has no relatives with the financial wherewithal to cosign. But this father of three teenagers remains determined. "Might as well try to transition over," he says. "I'd rather struggle on my own dime." The delay for first-time homebuyers has been building for some time. Three decades ago, nearly half of 25 to 34-year-olds owned a home. Now, it's fewer than one in three when measured on an individual basis, according to an Urban Institute study last year. By focusing on individuals rather than households, which the U.S. Census Bureau considers, the study exposes an additional trait of millennials. They're not forming households at the same rate as their parents. Instead, they're living with parents, relatives, or friends, delaying marriage and children. It's part inability for financial reasons, says Michael Seller, real estate and finance professor at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. But it's also a lack of desire. Homeownership is the American dream? I don't think young people share that philosophy. This change comes against a backdrop of two decades of tumult in the housing market that is unprecedented in post-war America, says Professor Reed of UC Berkeley. Home prices soared in the easy credit era of the early 2000s, crashed after the 2007-2009 financial crisis, and then soared again when mortgage rates fell to near record lows. As late as 2022, home buyers were scrambling to snap up homes before mortgages climbed too high. High mortgage rates then hit the housing market with a double whammy. Not only did they prevent first-time home buyers from buying, but they also discouraged older sellers from selling. Having locked in a low mortgage rate on their current home, would-be sellers didn't want to buy another home with a higher interest rate. Now that mortgage rates have eased a bit, more buyers are emerging. But their composition has changed, says Yong-Hyun Choi, a principal research associate at the Urban Institute. They have higher incomes, more education, and a greater ability to put down more than 20% on a house. The market was slower, but as of mid-February, the market has been crazy, says Francesca Lampert, a real estate agent in Menlo Park, California, where the median sales price tops $2 million. We've had a lot of buyers reaching out, ready to jump into the market. They say, "We don't care. We need to jump in and get a piece of this action and start building equity for ourselves, despite interest rates." Another plus, house flipping, the purchase of homes for remodeling and quick resale, which surged to new highs in 2022 and drove up home prices, especially at the lower end, has fallen dramatically. Eventually, some experts say, the market should adjust to allow more than only high-earning millennials to afford their first home. The gap isn't just financial. The affordability crisis has hit people of color especially hard, with 37% of Hispanic and 39% of Black renting households priced out of a median-priced home between March 2022 and March 2023, according to a study last summer by the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. The challenge is that the longer the market adjustment takes, the more inequality the current imbalance creates. Cities are looking to boost supply by loosening zoning rules on new home construction, although so far, restrictions on new housing keep getting tighter, says Professor Seller. We need more targeted policies on the demand side, says Ms. Choi of the Urban Institute. She points to assistance programs to help first-time buyers with down payments and credit programs that target specific neighborhoods or areas. Although federal legislation has stalled in Congress, some federal and state agencies target assistance for certain geographies or help renters establish credit through rental payments. Last year, Gio Tundo bought his first home in Cleveland, Mississippi, with no down payment, thanks to a rural development loan through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, his employer. The 20-something biological sciences technician also qualified for a low-interest loan, which made payments on his $100,000 home as cheap as the cost of renting a place, he says. I'm in a pretty decent situation. Amman, Jordan, Ramallah, West Bank, and Gaza. Hamas gambled with our lives. Gazans are now daring to speak out. By Taylor Luck, Special Correspondent, Fatima Abdul-Karim, Special Contributor, and another Special Contributor. Across the Gaza Strip, from markets to evacuee camps to social media channels, Palestinian frustration and anger with Hamas is on the rise. Complaints began with Hamas's apparent disregard for Gaza civilians who face the brunt of Israel's punishing military response to the October 7th attack, while Hamas fighters remained in tunnels. Now, with starvation, profiteering, and internal chaos on the rise, the militant group that has ruled the Strip for 17 years is nowhere to be found. We did not choose to be in a war that takes us from our homes, takes the lives of loved ones, and put our lives in a death game that we knew nothing about, says Bissan Natil, a youth organizer for a local Gaza non-governmental organization. Hamas didn't warn us or give any instructions to protect or help people. I don't know what they were thinking or what they expected people to do. But this is unacceptable for everyone in Gaza, says Walid, an aid worker in central Gaza who declined to use his full name. I feel that Hamas gambled with our lives at stake and lost. Rafat Naim, a Gaza businessman and former member of the Palestine Chamber of Commerce, says prior to the war, support for Hamas among Gaza residents was already limited. Hamas's popularity in the Gaza Strip was waning due to its governance failures and misallocation of funds, he says. The devastating impact of the conflict further entrenched this sentiment. The anger that has been simmering since the early days of the war, meanwhile, has only in recent weeks come to the surface. These are not organized calls or political protests against Hamas, but conversational complaints growing louder by the day. Tiny protests have been scattered. People now are very angry with Hamas, but at the same time, they are afraid to express the anger inside them by protesting or holding sit-ins, notes Wa'il Mohammed, a civil engineer and longtime Hamas critic in Gaza. He says 16 years of the Islamic Hamas's intimidation tactics, as well as its use of religious faith to push its ideology, made the population in Gaza docile. Now, with the lack of Hamas police officers on the streets and a reduced threat of being dragged off by its security services, people in Gaza, facing starvation, are more emboldened to criticize the movement in public. Some even curse it. This outspokenness does not mean Gazans' support, in principle, for armed resistance against the Israeli occupation has lessened. Nor has their view changed that the conflict is an Israeli war against the Palestinian people. A belief remains among most residents that, with the 17-year siege of Gaza, they have been punished for two decades by Israel, the international community, and the Palestinian Authority for Hamas's presence, and that the movement has never had a chance to act as a normal government. Yet growing disillusion with Hamas is impacting the group's future prospects, as residents see it as unresponsive, irresponsible, and lacking basic care for Gaza's people. All those interviewed stress that Hamas left the Gaza public in the dark even after Israel's counterattack began. There was a seeming lack of concern for civilians as Hamas forces retreated to their tunnels. Hamas followed the same old war plan and left the people to the mercy of the Israelis, says Walid, the aid worker. We gave in to Hamas for a long time, and we thought Hamas as a party would be prepared for the war after October 7th, as they claimed. But they were only ready to protect themselves, says Rana Al-Sayed, a mother and feminist activist from Gaza City, who was displaced four times by Israelis' offensives. This war is beyond Hamas's capabilities, says Ahmed, a Gaza photojournalist who blames intense targeting by Israel's military for the movement's inability to govern or protect its citizens. It cannot help itself, let alone the people. For some Palestinians in Gaza, the war has cemented the idea of Hamas as a militant faction looking out only for itself, rather than for the people it has governed since first being elected by a plurality in 2006. It has ruled unopposed since 2007, when it drove out its rival Fatah and seized the Strip. They see their role is to fight Israelis and not to care for the people. But since Hamas took control of the Gaza Strip, they implicitly agreed to take care of its people, says Walid, who, like many, sees Hamas as evading that responsibility. At least provide enough food for the people to not die of hunger. Build shelters and safe places. Establish a form of civic protection and law enforcement to keep people in check, the aid worker says. October 7th was nothing but a continuation of the series of political and military gambles that the movement has made since its inception, an operation that brought nothing but destruction, killing, displacement, and deportation of the residents of the Gaza Strip, says Mr. Mohammed, the civil engineer. He likens the movement to a group of mercenaries and militias that do not rise to the level of a Palestinian movement and don't care about Palestinian blood. He and others point to statements by Hamas's leadership abroad at the onset of the war that it was the responsibility of the United Nations and the international community, not Hamas, to protect Gaza civilians. With a breakdown of law and order, organized crime is increasing, and aid is looted and sold on the secondary market before many can get it. And there is a growing belief that not only does Hamas bear responsibility for the looting and profiteering through its absence, but it also may be complicit or participating in it. We have to buy food that was sent to Gaza as aid. We hear lots of rumors that this aid was stolen under the eyes of Hamas, sometimes in complicity with people from the government, says Walid. Mohammed, an accountant and former government employee, now in Rafah, says the links are clear between Hamas and aid theft across Gaza. We cannot provide definitive proof, but who has the guns? Who has the monopoly on force in Gaza? It's Hamas. The work of organized criminal groups wouldn't happen without their consent, Mohammed says via WhatsApp messaging. Dissent is also growing in the local business community. Members say they have long chafed under Hamas's restrictions, appropriation of incoming materials, corruption, and wars. They have lost businesses, farms, and homes in this war, but also have found no entity to facilitate a return of trade or even the distribution of basic aid. Despite rising anger, fear persists amid occasional reports of imams or civil society organizers being taken and disappeared by Hamas for voicing public criticism. Protesters gathering in northern Gaza were shot at by armed men. At the grassroots level, Hamas persists in its oppression, even amid these dire circumstances, notes Mr. Naeem, the businessman. Some Gazans are attempting to provide services and a sense of order. In Rafah, so-called protection committees, groups of local young men dressed in matching black clothes and masks, armed with batons, are providing basic security to markets and public areas. Mr. Naeem is one of several local business owners and community leaders who are attempting to form a council to facilitate the entry and distribution of aid and goods. They have set their sights on advocating for the border to open to resume a robust flow of aid and commerce into the Strip. Yet attempts to circumvent Hamas face steep obstacles and danger. Unverified reports emerge that Hamas executed a Mukhtar, or local community leader, in northern Gaza, allegedly for coordinating with the Israeli military for a separate initiative to facilitate aid. The incident appears to confirm what Palestinians believed. Israeli involvement would delegitimize and kill any alternative provision of services in Gaza. The occupation's civil administration has engaged with some community leaders and members of the private sector, notes Mr. Naim. This initiative is both unacceptable and risky for all involved on the Palestinian side. Most Palestinians in Gaza interviewed say they no longer want Hamas's rule, but a significant portion still support its existence as an armed movement. A lack of alternatives leaves Gazans unsure of their future. I still support Hamas as a liberation movement, but I am not satisfied with its uncalculated actions, notes Ahmed. As losses pile up for families in Gaza facing missile strikes, famine, and profiteering, more Gazans say the idea of trusting Hamas to govern the Strip again is unthinkable. I lost my mother, my husband lost half his family, and we lost our house. My children have known nothing but wars and escalations, says Ms. Al-Sayed. How can my children ever believe in Hamas, who are neither providing us with a bite to eat, nor allowing anyone else to do so? Perspectives on the world. The Monitor's view. When schools tap parental love. The pandemic's lingering impact on K-12 education, notably a record absenteeism among students, has forced American educators to look hard at how they can better engage parents. Nationwide gaps in student learning, a result of Zoom-only classrooms, still need urgent solutions. The usual home-school connections, such as parent-teacher meetings, are no longer seen as enough. Schools are even challenging a long-held assumption that some parents simply don't care much about their kids' schooling. Money is pouring in to find fresh approaches. The federal government recently spent $83 million to support family engagement in public schools. California has approved new standards for teachers in shaping their relationships with parents. Teachers, for example, must examine their attitudes and biases about a family's background, such as language, social status, or even homelessness. Private philanthropy is backing different techniques. A survey last year by Grantmakers for Education found that 60% of education funders support efforts to help families become more involved in their child's education. Half of those funders said they plan to give more for the cause. Many of the successes in shaping more sensitive engagement have resulted in at least one conclusion. Families really care, says Elizabeth O'Brien, co-founder of Family Education Lab, a nonprofit that helps school districts successfully include family engagement with curriculum. A former school psychologist, Dr. O'Brien adds that parents clearly want information about what their kids are learning and how they can help. The changes can be as simple as requiring fewer apps for parents to download. Communication can be more fluid, such as using texting. Demands for in-person meetings can be more flexible. Home visits by teachers to establish better relationships can build trust. A recent study found that schools that scored high on family involvement before the pandemic saw a 39% smaller increase in chronic absenteeism. Those schools also showed less decline in math and English. With family engagement, you see positive outcomes with behavior, motivation, high school graduation. So it's really wide-ranging, the positive benefits of that engagement with their child's learning, Dr. O'Brien says. With an attitude of giving and problem-solving, family engagement is a team effort well worth the buy-in from all sides. Parental love is there. It just needs better ways to blossom. The Monitor's View, Hoops of Joy in March Madness. In just a single weekend in March 2023, the city of Albany, New York, received a revenue bump large enough to cover nearly half of its annual budget for public works. Other small cities saw similar bursts in receipts. The reason? College basketball. Spring migrations have been underway. Red-winged blackbirds to the north, baseball fans to the south. Yet nothing stirs a human fluttering this time of year quite like March Madness, the annual college basketball championship tournament. Over 3 weeks, 134 games, 67 for men's teams, 67 for women's teams, will have generated nearly $10 billion in economic activity in host cities. The tournament draws fans to places they might otherwise never go. Many people have no direct connection to the teams they root for. They hop from city to city, drawn by those things that inspire joy: athletic grace, gallantry, community. I, more often than not, find myself rooting for the underdog team, wrote Jillian Brown, an innovation consultant at Peer Insight. One big reason is that we can see ourselves in this team. We've all been confronted with uphill battles where we're not expected to succeed, but with passion and grit, we do. One appeal of amateur athletics lies in its traditional motives. Amateurism, wrote philosopher Heather Reed at Morningside University in Iowa, is rooted in the Latin word for love, or doing something out of intention and not for external reward. College sports teach us to transform our love for an activity into excellence, she wrote in the Journal of Intercollegiate Sport. They engage uncommon character virtues. Team sports are a shared commitment to excellence. Nearly half of the teams make it to the national tournament by winning a regional championship. The rest are chosen by the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Then there are the brackets, as fans fill in charts predicting winners and losers. In the 85-year history of the tournament, no one has ever filled out a perfect bracket. On April 8th, just one team will be left standing. A new survey by OnePoll found that the average fan will spend 36 hours watching, talking, and thinking about college basketball. About the stumbles, the Cinderellas, and the shots that beat the buzzer. It isn't hard to see why. Love of excellence is a slam dunk. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the April 1st issue of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Tricia Beattie. So long for now.